Spirit Blade Underground, episode 440. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 440.
Hello and welcome back to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and community you can check out at christiangeekcentral.com. I'm Peter Franson, back from Christmas vacation and also from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live more and more for Christ. For more info and free goodies, check out spiritblade.com. All right, on the show today, we're not quite jumping back into the book of Ephesians yet. I mentioned that before I went on break, but I just wanted to remind you of that. We'll be getting back to that, hopefully. My plan is next week. But this week, I was going to have to fit in three reviews and a couple other tidbits, so I just didn't feel like there was quite going to be room for it. And plus, I was coming back in the middle of a week. I wanted to have more prep time to really do that segment properly. So on the show today, I'm going to share my reviews of Assassin's Creed, the movie, Passengers, and Underworld Blood Wars. Lots to talk about. Let's get to it. Assassin's Creed, the synopsis from 20th Century Fox reads, through a revolutionary technology that unlocks his genetic memories, Lynch, played by Michael Fassbender, or is it Fassbender? I'm going to say Fassbender, because I heard someone say it that way the other day, experiences adventures of his ancestor, Aguilar. I looked up a pronunciation guide for that, too. Aguilar. His ancestor Aguilar in 15th century Spain during the Spanish Inquisition. Calum discovers he is descended from a mysterious secret society, the Assassins, and amasses incredible knowledge and skills to take on the oppressive and powerful Templar organization in the present day. All right, so let's talk about story, script, pacing, that kind of thing. This movie flashes back and forth between modern day and the action-packed memory sequences during the Spanish Inquisition. The flashbacks, I thought, were actually fairly boring for me, even though they were very action-packed, until about the last one, because I couldn't identify with the mission and the values of the assassins, and I didn't feel like the action sequences were in a directly obvious way leading to the goals that the assassins had. And I also knew that Aguilar would survive until he got closer to his goals, you know, so oddly enough, they didn't have a whole lot of tension for me. The modern sequences, which actually make up, I think, probably more than half of the movie in the total running time, were much more interesting and involving as Cal deals with side effects of the tech that's used to induce these flashbacks, and that's called the Animus, is the name of that tech. And he sorts through, you know, he's also sorting through his immediate family history and discovering things about his parents that he never knew. And his motives also change, which has a direct effect on the plot. So now that's not to say that those modern sequences don't have any action in them. Actually, a lot of them have action sequences. I won't say more than that. I don't want to spoil anything. But don't think that just because more than half of the movie takes place in modern day that it doesn't have lots of cool Assassin's Creed-y type of action. There's plenty of cool action going on in the modern day. The story also nearly gets into some nice father-son drama, which I'm always a sucker for, but it doesn't quite get into that territory. It just really kind of teases the edges of it. Still, though, there's some nice character stuff that I wouldn't expect from a video game movie. And let me just go ahead and put this out there. This, I think, might be the most enjoyable quality experience I've had with a video game movie. I don't think that all video game movies suck. I just don't know that any of them have been really great. And I don't know if I'd describe this one as really great either, but I do think it's good. I definitely enjoyed it. Every now and then, the script has some dialogue bits that feel unnatural, but most of the time, the script I thought was solid enough for me, apart from some logic issues, which we're going to come back to that. The Animus, the flashback-inducing technology, is cool visually, but it doesn't make much sense practically. They got him in this harness, and they put these assassin's blades on him, and they have him spinning and jumping around. I'm like, why do they have to have him do all that? If this thing's plugging into the back of his head and giving him all these, you know, hallucinations of his ancestors' memories, why does he have to also jump around? And why, if he needs this thing to do the jumping around, does he not need poles to grab onto when he's doing things that involve grabbing poles and climbing poles? I mean, there's some kind of logical disconnect there. But, you know, there are several places in this movie that have logical disconnects. But that said, I kind of got over it, because visually it was interesting, you know, and I don't know, I got over it. the cast is all solid, but mostly there to do action. Michael Fassbender, we'll say, brings some subtext, I thought, to his character, and Marion Cotillard, is that how you say her name? I don't know. She's the head scientist for the flashback-inducing project, and she's nicely conflicted in this story. So I thought there was just some nice little touches going on with those two central characters. As far as the stunts and visuals go, cool action, cool fight scenes. They're mixing practical and CG effects, but mostly it has a practical, grounded feel in the flashback and modern sequences both. There's nothing groundbreaking going on with the visuals and the stunts, but the action beats and the choreography were mixed up just enough for me now and then to keep things visually interesting. All right, so one thing I always try to ask myself, is there anything of moral, philosophical, or spiritual significance in this that might trigger some worthwhile thought or conversation after or during, you know, the viewing of it? And I think so in this one. These Templars, in the main story, there's the Templars group versus the Assassins. And the Templars, they want to just kind of eradicate violence in the world. And the thing that they think is going to do that for them is this artifact called the Apple of Eden. Yes, they're talking about the fruit from the Garden of Eden, which they have just decided, yeah, definitely was an apple. there is a Hebrew word for apple used in the Old Testament. It's not in Genesis. That's purely tradition. The word in Hebrew in Genesis is just kind of a broad word that describes fruit or tree, you know. It felt like, you know, with them doing all these like scientific archaeological research, that like when they got around to doing like their Bible research, they just used like children's Sunday school curriculum or something. Every time they keep using this phrase, the Apple of Eden, the Apple of Eden, the Apple, the Apple. Every time they said the Apple of Eden, I was waiting for them to like pull out a flannel graph to describe. And this is where we think it might be today. So it just kind of felt ridiculous to me. I think a lot of people aren't going to have that problem, because I think probably a lot of people, the average moviegoer, doesn't know that like the Bible actually doesn't say apple. So I think for a lot of people, it's not going to be, you know, anything. But for me, I was like, oh, that just feels weird and ridiculous. So, you know, biblical history and archaeology, it's a real thing. It's been going on for a long time with real scholars whom I wish had been consulted to give some better language to the script in these parts, to just kind of ground it a little bit more. Of course, the Bible, which the Templars cite as their knowledge source for the apple, never says the fruit of the tree can even potentially, via some kind of manipulation, rob people of their free will, which is totally what they're counting on it to do in this story. If anything, the fruit from that tree broadened mankind's choices. If they keep reading their Bible, the Templars would know that mankind will not actually be rescued from its violent tendencies by some ancient artifact, but by the rescuing forgiveness and transformation that only Jesus makes possible, as well as by the ultimate quarantine of all evil that Jesus, not flawed human judges, will eventually bring about. Now, the assassins are a mess, too, although the movie doesn't showcase, I didn't think, their hypocrisy and dysfunction to the degree that I thought was implied in an interview with Michael Fassbender, in which he described the moral landscape as being very murky, you know, the implication being that there was not a real clear, like, good and bad team to be on. But I felt the movie was painting the Templars and their beliefs in a much more negative and extreme light than they did with the assassins. Although it's possible that the assassins' belief will be examined and criticized more in a sequel, which I would really like to see. They certainly, I don't want to say they were like upholding the Assassin's Creed, which we'll get to in a second, as like, this is good and reliable and shouldn't be questioned, you know? But at the same time, it wasn't really questioned or examined or shown to have any kind of dark sides or faults in this movie. So it'll just be interesting to kind of see what happens. The Assassin's Creed upholds two primary belief statements, which are nothing is true and everything is permitted. But these both completely undercut the assassins and their goals in a devastatingly self-defeating way. First off, if nothing is true, that includes the statement that nothing is true, okay? If that's not what you meant, guys, you got to expand on that a little bit. You can't just say nothing is true. Before that, the full statement is something like, while the Templars or other people blindly follow truth, we remember that nothing is true. Like, really? Nothing is true? If that's true, it's a self-defeating statement. And even setting that aside, it also means that, like, any additional statement made by an assassin ever in any other context should be considered untrustworthy. But you can't even really get that far because the statement itself is undercutting and self-defeating and therefore nonsensical. Second, if everything is permitted... Everything is permitted. You know, they say that, you know, these guys, they have their moral constraints, da-da-da, but we believe this. Well, okay, if you're saying that everything is permitted, then you're saying that is a moral good to permit everything. So you're not exactly free from having these kinds of, like, moral absolutes yourself. And also, if everything is permitted, then that would include the attempts of the Templars to remove free will and control our lives. So really, assassins, you should not be fighting their efforts to do what they want to do, because... everything is permitted. So anyway, if the tenets of this creed are meant to be extreme, and, you know, and we're supposed to, as audience members, say, well, they're kind of whacked out too, I don't see these statements being presented as extreme in this story. In fact, these ideas, although self-defeating, are among the most popular values held by many Americans today. We don't want to be confronted with the truth. And even though the Bible would teach against these things, I'm talking about believing Christians too. We fall into, maybe even on a subconscious level, gravitating toward these things. It is just what comes naturally to us. These, you know, let's see, I'm falling off my notes here, and that's where everything gets off the rails. Crap, I'm tired, it's late. I don't usually do this late. Oh yeah, we don't want to be... confronted with the truth, but we'd rather just kind of believe what we want to believe and be left alone to believe what we want to believe and not have our beliefs challenged in any way. That's kind of like not cool to challenge someone else's beliefs. And we also want to be left alone to do whatever we want. We just permit me to just have everything be permissible in my life, you know? My hope is that in the sequel that is clearly intended at the end of this movie... they will explore the dark-sided ramifications of these unexamined beliefs that make up the Assassin's Creed. It would help keep Cal's journey interesting and conflicted, and would also be a good way, good thing for the average moviegoer to think about as well. Okay, so I have no idea what your tastes are in movies or anything like that. If I were a time traveler, I'd go back in time and say, Peter, skip this one for now. You don't need to see it. You've never played any of these Assassin's Creed games, and so you have no particular draw to this. You can skip this for now until, at least, the box office guarantees a sequel will come. Because the ending, no spoilers, the ending, it's one of those kinds of like, well, we've done this little thing right now, but the big battle is to come, and we must begin preparing for it. You know, so it kind of like... yanks the rug out of the climax a little bit in this movie, because it's clearly like set up. It's the climax itself is still just kind of set up for what's coming, you know, which just feels kind of presumptuous. I'm like, guys, I wish you would have just made a much more self-contained thing. Sure, leave some unresolved bits, that's fine, but make it a little more self-contained so we can just go away from this movie saying, yeah, or something. I mean, I don't know. And maybe other people have very different experiences, but Peter, that's not going to be your experience when you watch this movie. You're going to leave feeling more like this is a potentially a solid setup to a couple of great movies that are coming, rather than a truly satisfying experience on its own. It's rated PG-13 for intense sequences of violence and action, thematic elements, and brief, strong language. All right, those are my thoughts. I'd love to get yours in the comments below. I'd love to hear if you're Assassin's, if you're a fan of the games. This movie actually made me, I want to like stop recording, get this thing uploaded and done with, because I want to revisit these Assassin's Creed games. I've never given them a try before. I've liked some of the Ubisoft games that have come out, like the Far Cry games, although there's some things about how they structure missions there and how they funnel you in your missions to do them a certain way that have been really, really annoying to me and have kept me away from trying out the Assassin's Creed games, but it's such a celebrated series. It's got a movie now. I actually want to stop recording and go watch some reviews of the Assassin's Creed games and see if maybe they'll be worth giving a try, because this movie kind of made me jazzed for the whole concept. I want to remind you guys to go check out the other members of the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, the Untold podcast, POSTOS, and Helix Reviews. For more information about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com. Passengers, starring Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt. The synopsis reads, a spacecraft traveling to a distant colony planet and transporting thousands of people has a malfunction in its sleep chambers. As a result, two passengers are awakened 90 years early. All right, so let me just talk about the story, the script, and just kind of how the pacing is in general. If you watch this movie, you're in for a sci-fi, drama, romance, suspense flick. Which is an amazing balance of all those things mixed together. Neither one really kind of dominates the movie. So, I mean, for example, if you're not really into romance, this thing also functions for much of it as a sci-fi drama, or in the latter half, a sci-fi suspense movie. On the other hand, if you're really just kind of into romance, maybe not into sci-fi, you know, I think if you're into just two of those categories, sci-fi, romance, drama, suspense, if you're just into two of those, then I think there's enough in this movie that will keep you engaged. At least it did for me. I happen to like all of those, and it was, you know, as a nerd, especially awesome to have sci-fi in the mix. The tension hangs on a secret that Jim is keeping from Aurora. These are the two main characters for much of the movie, and then further tension is later added when the couple has to deal with dangerous malfunctions across the systems of the ship. The movie opens as kind of like a straight drama with no romance at the beginning, just kind of like this isolated kind of character portrait in a sense, and then it moves into romance and builds and crescendos as a suspense movie, and yet each new type of genre that's introduced only adds a layer, I think, rather than negating or replacing the genre before. So it's like, you know, when the romance is introduced, it's not that it's not a drama anymore. It's still very much a character drama, you know, and so on and so forth as each of those, you know, kind of layers is added. And by the last 30 minutes, it's a drama with romance and suspense all in this great sci-fi space setting that I really enjoyed. I would love more movies to kind of mash up genres like this one, especially combining sci-fi or fantasy. Fantasy especially, because we've got some sci-fi doing this already, mixing sci-fi or fantasy with drama and or romance. We've got a few of those. We've got like the Time Traveler's Wife, About Time, which actually have the same leading lady in both of those, strangely enough. And, you know, and a few others. We got the Frequency would be an example of a sci-fi drama. I would love to see some kind of, I don't know what it would be, like an elf romance or something like that. I don't know how you pull that off and really make it work, you know, and taken seriously by people that maybe aren't fans of fantasy. But anyway, I'd love to see more of these kinds of mashups. This movie was really moving to me in several places, but also interesting from a sci-fi perspective. And I think it also functions well as a drama that explores our need for relationships and purpose in life. So, I got to tell you, I was really satisfied with my experience watching this movie. I really enjoyed both Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence in this movie. I've seen Chris Pratt in Guardians of the Galaxy, but I didn't really like that movie all that much. I didn't find it all that funny. So it was neat to see him in a different role, but still in a sci-fi setting. That was cool. And Jennifer Lawrence, I've mostly just known her as Mystique, but I've seen one or two of the dramas she's been in, both of them really engaged me and made me feel for the loss of their characters as their experience, their characters are experiencing, as they both face this prospect of, a potentially isolated life in the loneliness of space, Michael Sheen is also charming as the android bartender that serves as the closest thing to a human companion that the two lead characters have. He adds, just a little bit of comic relief, but there's, it's not like not enough to add comedy to that stack of, genres and settings. But yeah, it's just a nice little bit of relief to some of the relationship tension and just kind of like a reason to smile every now and then as you watch this movie. Most of the CGI, as we move on to stunts and visuals and stuff, stunts I won't really talk about. I would say that there were stunts, but I think I wasn't taken out of the movie. That's a really good thing. That's a sign in my book of really good stunts and visuals, is that they don't take me out of the movie. They just continue to propel me inward closer to the drama and build the suspense. And most of the CGI in this movie involved recreating machines and artificial life, like, robots or big props or whatever, which means that my cursed CGI detecting eyes were pretty happy and never really taken out of the story because of the effects. There wasn't much life to potentially recreate with this, with CGI in this kind of story. But I'll say again that I think current CGI works best when avoiding the recreation of living things and just sticking to recreating machines and immobile objects. In any other case, just to get on my soapbox for a second, I would much prefer to see animatronics or puppets, or CGI-enhanced animatronics and puppets. But don't make the whole thing out of CGI, because my frickin' eyes are cursed, and it just totally feels like I'm watching cartoons when that happens. All right, so is there anything, I always like to ask myself, is there anything of moral, philosophical, or spiritual significance that might bring about worthwhile thought or conversation as a result of watching this movie? And I think so. I'll go from kind of like the least noticeable to me to the most noticeable, starting with the plot and how it demonstrates how both selfish choices and natural evils can be used as a catalyst for something good and every bit worth the resulting suffering that's involved, that comes out of those selfish choices or those natural evils. One of the big questions that can be a stumbling block, or at least is presented as the stumbling block for many people's faith, is, why do bad things happen to good people, or why does God let so much evil and destruction run rampant, seemingly, and how could God justify all of these, evils and horrible things that happen in the world, and I think through both the story of Joseph and his brothers selling him into slavery, and then in the cross itself, God demonstrates in actual history how these horrible evils can be used as a catalyst by God to bring about something that is much better and much greater and totally worth it. So I think that there is some in how the plot is constructed. Come up with some examples here, even though it's fiction, of how that kind of thing could potentially happen. The premise and story also, I think, work well as a metaphor for biblical marriage. The Bible treats marriage as an exclusive relationship of love that is meant to last until death, despite intense difficulties or conflict. The divorce rate among Christians in America, last time I checked, which has been a little while, is the same as that of non-Christians, which probably says something about how we as Christians typically view our Bibles in relationship to our everyday lives, which is to say that we don't see the Bible as being very relevant to our everyday lives, unfortunately. And at the very least, unless most Christian divorces are due to infidelity, I think it's an indicator that many Christians see marriage as something that can be just kind of given up on when major conflicts arise in the relationship. But although the two passengers in this movie aren't married, they are in this situation where they recognize that, you know what? No, there are no other relationship options. This is it. We are in this, and there are no other options. And that reality forces them to work through their problems, which results in a beautiful model of genuine biblical love that I found moving. Standing out even more than those two themes, though, and certainly I think intended by the filmmakers, is the theme of purpose. A repeated quote and slogan of the movie goes something like, don't be so intent on where you want to be that you miss out on making the most of where you actually are. My wife and I, on the way to the theater, knowing nothing about this movie really, were discussing, you know, our personal difficulties with desiring significance or wanting to feel like we're fulfilling our purpose through our day-to-day lives and routines. And, you know, we both feel that natural desire to one day look back on our lives and feel like we accomplished something, you know. And we still feel that pull, even knowing the truth that it isn't our accomplishments that make us significant. It's the fact that God is, you know, made us in some way to be reflections of him and then fixated on us to the point of becoming adding humanity to himself and then dying so that we could be reconciled to him forever. You know, I mean, that's what makes us immensely valuable, immensely significant. And also accomplishing what other people may or may not find impressive doesn't really bring fulfillment. So those are the kinds of things that my wife and I were thinking about as we came into this movie. You know, the reality is that fulfilling our purpose is as simple as Micah 6:8, even though it's simply stated, but there's a lot more involved in actually applying it to our lives, you know. But Micah 6:8 says, he has told you, O man, what is good, and what does Yahweh require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. And, you know, we can live that way even through simple lives that no one even notices. And that's very similar to the message of this film. I don't want to say too much about the message of the film because it might potentially give away kind of where things go in the story, you know. But I think there's a similar message and the idea that, like, well, you know, I'll give that quote again that seems to be a focal point of the movie. Don't be so intent on where you want to be, what you want to accomplish, what you want to achieve, that you miss out on making the most and appreciating the beauty of the situation that you're in and the good that can be found there. So I have no idea what your tastes in movies are, but if I were a time traveler, I'd go back in time and say, hey, Pater, okay, first off, you're curious about the nudity thing and how's that going to play out. The nudity in the PG-13 rating info basically amounts to two brief shots of Chris Pratt's butt. Although Jennifer Lawrence likes to wear a tiny swimsuit and a few other skimpy outfits that are shown very briefly, the sexual scenes are brief and either obscured or shadowed. You should be okay with this one. Just watch in your peripheral vision during the swimming or the sexy stuff. This is a great movie that both you and your wife are really going to enjoy, Pater. You're going to be moved by it. You're going to share a meaningful personal discussion over this movie on the drive home. It's going to be a great date for both of you guys. It's rated PG-13 for sexuality, nudity, as I described, and action/peril.
Data collection complete. Activating MusicNet 1.0.
Well, guys, I'm already thinking ahead a bit to the summer of free, believe it or not. It's not that I feel like I need to plan this early. It was just kind of on my mind. And I need some feedback and maybe some ideas or something. I got to troubleshoot this. I want to modify the retro game stream that I usually do. And, you know, I've been in past Summer of Freeze an advocate of retro gaming as a way to kind of save money, you know, to instead of buying the new hotness, kind of rekindling your love for some of the older classics that you already have on hand. But I want to actually broaden that out to some concept like
the Great Backlog Burn or Summer Backlog Burn or something, since retro gaming can actually end up costing money. And that's definitely not what I want to do. And that's totally against the spirit of the Summer of Free. I want to instead put out a call with some kind of incentive for people to give attention to their backlog games, which may be retro games, but games that you already have. And retro gaming isn't necessarily games that you already have. So the idea is put a call out with some kind of incentive for people to give attention to their backlog games that they haven't finished or that they haven't squeezed quite all of the life out of yet. The hope would be that with all the backlog gaming that, you know, they wouldn't feel the need to buy the new hotness, whatever it is, of which little is ever released during the summer anyway. So, what I'm puzzling over is the incentive for people to get involved. You know, it's one thing for me to talk it up and hype it up and do it myself, but to get other people involved, I'm like, well, you know, beyond my enthusiasm, what could possibly entice them to take a look at their back catalog and kind of join me in this effort of exercising and developing contentment with what we already have? The only idea I have right now is for the that the event would run for a month, maybe two, and maybe participants would like take smartphone screenshots of the end game screens of their games as they finish them, that they can submit, you know, and then a certain number of these screenshots submitted will get them a certain reward. And I can, of course, offer downloads from the Spirit Blade Productions store or some other kind of shout-out or custom recognition slash involvement on the podcast or the YouTube channel, but I don't know how much any... you know, an incentive, any of those things would be. So I don't have like really a budget to actually go out and like purchase prizes and stuff like that. Even something like, say, the T-shirts that are made for Christian Geek Center on Spirit Blade Productions, you know, there's a back end cost for me. And I really don't on the store. I charge very little, if anything, above what the back end cost is on those. So that's what I'm trying to figure out is how can I do this, you know, without turning this into the summer of expense for Spirit Blade Productions. I'm also interested in some kind of like achievement slash trophy based reward acknowledgement, you know, like maybe a certain number of achievements gained on a game is equal to, you know, the photo taken of an end game screen. And, you know, you could use before and after screenshots of your achievement slash trophy list for that game and use that, those before and after shots as, you know, authentication. But, you know, with that idea, I'm not sure how many achievements or trophies would be either comparable or comparable. I'm never sure which way you're supposed to pronounce that. There's probably one for Britain or England or whatever the crap you other people that speak fancy. And people like me in America, or that are just like me, not like me, but like me, but not in whatever, other people that don't do it that way. So anyway, you know, what would be kind of equal to finishing? And, you know, the trophies and achievements for each game, they're so different. Some are really easy to get, some are hard to get. So all of this is just really murky and unformed in my mind right now. So I'd love to get feedback on ideas for how to get people involved in playing their backlog of games, even if that's not some kind of, you know, like reward system for screenshots or whatever. You know, I'm just trying to figure out how can I entice people to just take a month or two and get into their backlog of games instead of buying the new hotness. So I'd love to get your ideas. I did start a thread up in the under the brainstorm shelter at the forums at christiangeekcentral.com. So you can comment there, or you can send me an email at paeter@spiritblade.com. Or really anywhere you see me online that has the ability to comment, you're welcome to put your thoughts there as well. So any kind of feedback or thoughts, ideas, or whatever that you have on that would be appreciated. All right. This week at christiangeekcentral.com, you'll see that the Untold Podcast is now on Patreon. The podcast, there was a typo in my thing and it made my whole sentence sound wrong. The Untold Podcast releases new free Christian speculative fiction in audio format every month, and supporting them helps them to pay their contributors the industry standard compensation. Their monthly fundraising goal will also enable them to receive national recognition and compete in the general market for storytelling excellence. So you can check out the link in the show notes for this episode of the podcast to check out the Untold Podcast Patreon page and consider supporting them. Let's see, what else? Oh, as always, just a quick reminder, if you want to leave a review of our audio dramas from Spirit Blade Productions on iTunes or Amazon, that would be very helpful, as well as reviews and ratings for this podcast on iTunes or other podcatchers would be great. I think that's about all I wanted to say about that. All right. Okay, kiddo, pop quiz time. Best movie franchise.
The Terminator.
Not even close. The Matrix. Best TV show.
Star Trek.
What? Farscape. You have to know that it's Farscape. It's like you're not even my son. Unless you're not my son.
I don't like your voice. It irritates me.
Hey, wait.
Let's make another call.
No, please.
And another, and another, and another. You are very messy. Okay. Bye-bye.
Underworld Blood Wars. The synopsis reads, the next installment in the blockbuster franchise. Underworld Blood Wars follows vampire death dealer Celine, Kate Beckinsale, as she fends off brutal attacks from both the Lycan clan and the vampire faction that betrayed her. With her only allies, David and his father Thomas, she must stop the eternal war between Lycans and vampires, even if it means she has to make the ultimate sacrifice. All right, I'm a big fan of at least two of the Underworld movies. I really enjoyed the first one, even though it was kind of like, in many ways, ripping off of the aesthetics of The Matrix. I really liked Underworld Evolution as well, and I loved the prequel starring Michael Sheen, Rise of the Lycans. That was my favorite of the series. And it's kind of, for me, gone off the rails with Underworld Awakening, which was the last one that came out about 3 years ago. And so I was really hoping that this one would kind of right the boat and get it back to the kind of things that I liked about the series. So let me tell you what I think. First off, let's talk about just the story, and this is probably where I'm going to spend most of my time. The intro voiceover just, like, gets the daughter out of the way. Celine picked up a daughter in the last movie, and they kind of ditched Michael in the story. He became a background character, and this one was about, and Awakening was about, like, realizing, coming to terms with the fact that she has a daughter, and then eventually getting around to, okay, I have this daughter, now let's go find Michael. And that's where the Awakening movie ends. Well, in this movie, in the intro voiceover, they get the daughter out of the way. The daughter is in hiding, and even from Celine, she's being kept secret to keep Lycans and vampires from getting her blood, which could make either race apparently much more powerful. And so the daughter's off in hiding. Celine finds herself again in the war between vampires and Lycans. Maybe I got distracted, but I kind of missed exactly why she was bothering to get in the mix of all that. The story was originally going to be a reboot of the series, starring the vampire David, which is the son of, like, one of the elders of the major, you know, whatever council of vampires. And David was introduced in the last film, and this movie feels like a modified version of that intended story. The focus is divided all over the place, divided between Celine and David and the ambitious leaders that are on the vampire and Lycan side of the war, including subplots for each of those leaders. As in the last movie, this is not a series about star-crossed lovers anymore. I wish it was. It's not even about Celine much of the time. And the focus is divided so much that I didn't have time to care about any of the characters and their motivations. The scenes were edited so quickly, even when they were having dialogue that I think was supposed to be character building. Sometimes you just need some silence in the space between those lines of dialogue so that the actors have time to give us a little subtext so that we can pick up on something some internal feeling or motivation that's just not exactly what is on the black and white written page. You know, I like a little bit of character, you know, so that I can care about these people. I would love to hear what the filmmakers were thinking with taking the series where they have. I would have preferred a hard reboot over this seeming attempt at slowly transitioning us over to having David as our lead character. His background and his motives haven't been explored over the course of the two movies he's been in now anywhere near the way Celine's motives were explored over just one, you know? I mean, within the first, like, 45 minutes of the first Underworld movie, you can at least tell that there's an attraction between her and this guy Michael, which is putting her at odds with, you know, all the people that are in her life that she's ever known, you know? And that just took about 45 minutes to establish that level of tension. And we just haven't gotten near enough about this David guy's background, what he cares about, you know, for me to really care about him. So I have no reason to root for him as a hero. He's a decent guy, but being a decent guy in an action movie isn't enough for me to really want to feel for him to succeed and rise above the all the crap that's being flung at him. Instead, I would have preferred them opening the movie with a scene in which Celine and her daughter find Michael, and then she watches them both die. Now, that's not my ultimate preference, but it just seems like that's kind of how the filmmakers were like, we got to get rid of the daughter and we got to get rid of the love interest. Let's just have Celine doing action stuff. Okay, well, if you've got to get them out of the way, then at least bring them both in and, like, do CG versions of Scott Speedman's face again like you did in the last movie. Oh, my gosh. But get those characters in there long enough to kill them off so that she is just totally shattered by that, and then the rest of the movie can be this revenge flick, you know, which is very emotionally fueled. And since I have a history, at least with the Michael character, not so much, I didn't really have a chance to develop care for the daughter character, but I might have felt a little bit there. Then I could have sympathized a little bit. You know, you have two movies of this Michael character and the bond that she's established with him. So use that to fuel her motivation in this movie. I just didn't feel it. But yeah, then make this one like the last movie where, like, on this revenge-fueled, you know, tear, she just, like, wipes out the vampires or the werewolves or both or whatever she's got to do. But, you know, just kind of use that as the catalyst to bring this whole thing crashing down. That would have been a cool way to do it. But instead, we don't get an update on Michael until near the end of the movie. I won't give any spoilers for that. But the update there did help to bring a tiny amount of much-needed emotion, I think, to Celine's story and her action scenes. And Celine's story, though, is still way open-ended as the credits roll. So the movie also changed the world a bit. Vampires are dressed a bit less in the classy goth style and more in the kind of nightclubby, fetishy style of the Matrix movies, if you can think back to those. There's also a white-haired clan of vampires with mystical powers that's introduced, which felt weird to me given how much these movies have tied the mythos of vampires and lycans to biology and tried to root it in, like, you know, them being, you know, just kind of freaks of nature, just these kind of biological oddities, you know, rather than being supernatural in origin. Well, suddenly they bring for the first time this what seems to me to be clearly supernatural elements into the story. So that just felt, it just felt weird. It just feels like in so many ways this series has lost its way and its sense of identity of what it's about. I love the visual aesthetic of the series, and there's still enough of that absolutely present, even though they went a little bit, you know, latexy in some of the vampire costume designs. There's still a lot of that ancient goth meets modern weapons and tech. You know, I love those, you know, mashing up those backdrops. And then the serious tone that at least it's aiming for, I appreciate. I love the monster movie aspect when people are changing and screaming as they change. And, you know, I love that kind of stuff. And I love the superhero style action, you know, but none of that makes up for a lack of characters that I can care about. So the whole movie really fell flat for me. I never cringed out of distaste, like, oh, that's cheesy, oh, that's terrible, oh, that's horrible acting there, whatever, you know. I was just largely uninterested as I sat in the theater. And my uninterested brain was then left free to pick at logistical plot problems that normally wouldn't be on my radar, which made things even worse. You know, they introduced this nightshade poison that could, like, kill normal vampires instantly. And I'm just like, crap, if you could stick that on your weapons, how did the Lycans not know about this? They've been around for so long, we've had how many movies, there's never been any mention of this poison that if you put it on a blade can instantly kill a normal vampire. Where the crap was this in the franchise leading up to this point? Also, why don't vampires ever strike while the Lycans are changing? I know that as a movie, they kind of want to showcase the Lycans changing, da, 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 da. But I don't know how many times in this movie I saw, you know, vampires just kind of like watching at the ready as their enemy Lycans turned from their human form into their werewolf form. And it seems to be a time where they're kind of like contorting and stuff like that. And I'm like, strike now, strike now. But they don't ever take advantage of that tactic. Celine also did this super cool, like, super speed move to kill a bunch of Lycans, you know. And then like a few seconds later, there's a bunch more enemies in the room, and she doesn't do that again to take care of them. I'm like, why doesn't she just do that again? That was cool, and it totally took care of them. So there's just all these little kind of logical inconsistencies that maybe exist in the other movies in the franchise, but because I don't care about the characters, my mind is just more free to... I got nothing else to think about and care about, so I'm like, oh, what's that? That's weird, you know. So, big bummer. As far as the cast, you know, I don't think any of these actors are bad, but they weren't given material, I don't think, to showcase their abilities. Compare this movie to Michael Sheen's fantastic performance as Lucian, specifically in Rise of the Lycans. Man, that was a tragic, haunting performance in a couple scenes, not through the whole movie. But, oh, I just, that is such a, so much more character-driven and emotionally involving compared to this movie. And that's why it's my favorite of the series. As far as, like, stunts and visuals, I don't know. The werewolves haven't gotten much better over the course of the series. They still swap back and forth between obvious CGI, which is obvious to my cursed eyes anyway. You know, I just have eyes that pick out CGI. But, you know, maybe to a lot of other people, it won't bother them at all. But then they swap over to these stiff physical suits for the werewolves that lack any realistic joint movement. Now, I'd still take doing that, swapping over and having some physical, you know, version of the werewolves on set over doing all CG. But I would have liked to have seen significant improvement in the quality of both the CG and the articulation of the werewolf suits. Okay, so I always try to ask myself, you know, is there anything of moral, philosophical, or spiritual significance in these movies that might stimulate worthwhile thought or conversation as a result of checking it out? Well, not much jumped out. I mean, I really felt like I had to look for it. It's just not that kind of movie that's really, I don't think, trying to say anything, you know? It just does what it does, which is probably fine for most people that are, you know, watching these movies and that are fans of these movies, I would guess, because they keep making them. One character that dies and comes back to life says later that they are no longer afraid of death because they've experienced it once already. But I'd argue that this was like a near-death experience in which, you know, perhaps by biological measurements they were dead. But, you know, I think, you know, we give a lot of weight to near-death experiences as if they are actual death experiences. But it's worth keeping in mind that when we hear about near-death experiences, actual death is something people don't come back from. They might be biologically, you know, inert, but they're not, you know, in the true sense, the all-encompassing sense of that word, dead. So I think we shouldn't look to those kinds of stories, those near-death experience stories, as indicators of what the eternal post-life state is for humans. But anyway, that's really just me magnifying one little line and, like, trying to find something, you know, worthwhile to think or talk about. I also think it's interesting that the filmmakers shy away from giving us a continuation of the Celine / Michael romance or the mother-daughter story. The first three movies, two of them featuring Celine and Michael, the other one featuring Lucian and Sonia, were these star-crossed lover dramas, you know? And we haven't seen that ever since the last movie came out. They've just abandoned that type of tension in the drama. So they haven't given us a continuation of that. They also haven't given us a continuation of the mother-daughter story, which I was just like, man, it was totally underdeveloped, in my opinion, in Awakening, and I was hoping that maybe they would get into it more, or, like I said, at least kill her off, and I don't know. And I think that's probably because developed family dramas, whether it's romance or parent-child, don't sell to the target audience. That's my guess. I'd love to see Hollywood inject more developed romance and family relationships into these kinds of movies. You know, if all we knew was what movies told us, you'd think that a relationship kind of just hits its absolute peak when you finally have sex, or maybe when you get married, you know. But my wife and I just celebrated yesterday our 15th anniversary, and trust me, there are plenty of dramatic ups and downs that can come long after the honeymoon is over. There's so much, you know, potential for dramatic material that could be mined from a long-term marriage relationship, or from, same goes for having kids, as I've begun discovering over the last 9 years. That said, Hollywood, as I think I implied a moment ago, is probably just reacting to the market here, and the target audience is probably somehow giving off data that says we don't care about marriage or family relationships. And as a potential indicator of where we're at as human beings, that's a real bummer. All right, well, I have no idea what your tastes are in movies, but if I were a time traveler, I'd go back in time and say, Peter, wait. You want to Redbox this, or you want to buy it real cheap in the bargain bin before the next movie releases, which is already in development and sounds like it will serve as an end to this franchise and or a beginning to its next leg. Celine's story is not over. It will likely be concluded in the next movie, and your only chance of enjoying this movie is if somehow it looks better retroactively in light of the next movie. I don't know what they're going to do that would make that happen, but we'll see if that movie is even ever made. Feedback. Give me your thoughts on this podcast, Christian Geek Central, the YouTube channel, or anything else we're doing. What should we keep? What should we change? Or what's on your mind you'd like a potentially uninformed opinion on? We want to make this show and all of Christian Geek Central as fun, as useful as we can, but we've got to hear from you to do that. You can send an email or audio file recorded on your phone, a little bit of my North Dakota roots popping in there. Recorded on your phone to paeter@spiritblade.com. I'm not actually from North Dakota originally. I was born in eastern Montana, but my mom has family in North Dakota, so we were living in kind of eastern Montana and visiting western North Dakota quite a bit. Anyway, so if you're curious. I had a great time off over the break, guys. So thank you for your patience with the lack of content, because the rest was really great for me. I had a great time just doing lots of Christmassy stuff and keeping super busy until that wonderful moment, Christmas Eve, where I get to relax, go to the Christmas Eve service, just take in the meaning of what that celebration is about, and then experience a foretaste of the rest we have in eternity by, after that, taking some time off and just being with family and resting. Oh, that was good. It was really cool. And I had family in from out of town I don't get to see very often at all. It was just a really good time. And then as far as my, you know, isolated nerd time, I really got into Assassin's Creed. You know, I did like that movie enough that it got me curious about, like, the world of Assassin's Creed, you know? And so I got on Amazon. I saw that the first one was really cheap. And so I bought it. And I know people have told me before, and I've read before, and people have told me since I bought this, they're like, oh, Assassin's Creed 2 is where you should start. Well, I don't want to miss any of the story. And I don't know how good the recap is, and I might always just kind of have it wondering in the back of my mind, yeah, am I missing something? How good was that recap? I don't know. So I am playing the first one, and I'm really enjoying it, but I've played enough Ubisoft games, namely the Far Cry games, starting with 2, 3, and then 4, to know that there are going to be some story missions that really frustrate me, because they're very difficult for me, usually because there's some kind of timed mission, or there's some kind of, like, escort mission, or some stupid thing that has nothing to do with the skills you're developing in the open world activities, and is also very narrow in how you're able to approach it, despite the fact that Ubisoft is always says on the back of these games, where is it? Let me see, I got, let me see if they do it for Watch Dogs, too. As Marcus Holloway, it's your choice. Use hacking, stealth, and hand-to-hand, or go in with guns blazing. That's not as strongly stated. But if you look at... by the way, I bought Watch Dogs 2 also. But like they'll say like, oh, it's an open world. You can approach missions however you want. And then like in the middle of a Far Cry 3 or Far Cry 4 mission, it's like, you are exiting the mission zone. I'm like, dude, this is the perfect sniper location. Okay? Do not tell me I can make the shot from here if your freaking invisible wall would just leave me alone. Good gravy. So much for open world. And same thing with, like, Assassin's Creed announced it right away. And, you know, this is early days for the world of open world action games, period. And, you know, and certainly for the Assassin's Creed series. But it's like, oh, open world, and they talk on the back of the box how, you know, you can do... I don't remember exactly what they said. I can't remember what I read online about the game in terms of their official publicity for it and what's actually on the back of the box. But, you know, that's how they market this thing. And then you get in there, and there's only certain sections of each city that are accessible, and they, you know, there are not invisible walls, but like digital coding walls because you're in this kind of simulated flashback and thingy. I also really got into a Skyrim Special Edition a lot again. I'd gotten off of it for just a little. What was I playing? I think I was going back and forth before the break between that and Elminage Original, which I think I've already talked about on the podcast. It's like a first-person party-based, turn-based dungeon crawler. No plot, none of that boring crap walking around town talking to people to pick up quests and stuff. It is just you go to town, you get your stuff upgraded, and then back to the dungeon, baby, for fighting and looting and building your characters, you know. Oh, that's been some good stuff. That was on the Vita, which I play more than half the time on my PS TV, so I can play it on a TV, but really been enjoying that. But no, I got it back into Skyrim Special Edition a lot during the break and was kind of alternating between that and Assassin's Creed. I did a little bit of Diablo 3 for PS4, which I bought. Mainly, I was like, well, I mean, in the back of my mind, I said, I'll get it eventually when it goes on sale. And it did go on sale, as I was hoping it would, before January, because first time on consoles, they're having these seasonal events where you can, you know, there's just kind of seasonal. I don't really know all the details, but the big one for January is celebrating 20 years of Diablo. And for the first time, they're going to do it again every year. You can go through all the dungeon levels of the first Diablo game in the Diablo 3 engine, which I thought was kind of cool. And but you can only do that in adventure mode. Only in adventure mode. And although I've completed Diablo 3 and its expansion on the Xbox 360, which is not getting the seasonal stuff, only the PS4 and Xbox One on consoles are getting the seasonal stuff. Adventure mode is not unlocked until you beat at least the main campaign and I think the Reaper of Souls expansion as well. So that sucked big time. To realize, oh crap, I bought this thing thinking I was going to be able to do this January event, and the only way I could do it is if I just totally focus all of my gaming time for like the next 2 weeks on beating Diablo 3 and the expansion. And I don't want to do that. So add that to the backlog that I'll be tackling this summer. let's see, what else? Oh yeah, and I bought Watch Dogs 2, which I haven't gotten into a ton. I'm still with, you know, with these Ubisoft games, I have to figure out what it is you want me to do in these games, you know? I mean, like, how do I succeed? Sometimes I feel like they don't explain, like in Assassin's Creed, it took me a while to figure out how to do, not a retort, but a, you know that thing when the guy swings at you and then you say, you swing at me, haha, I swing at you, you missed, and now I swing, a counter attack, thank you. Thank you myself. So they'll say, like, in the instructions, you know, just before your opponent attacks you. It's like, what do you mean, just before they attack? Just before they swing? Just before they hit? When exactly? Because I've learned through trial and error that, like, oh, you have something a little bit more specific in mind than your broadly worded description of how to execute a counterattack. And the same thing I felt like kind of was true with Watch Dogs 2. It's like I was just kind of thrown in. The tutorial for me was not precise. And part of it might be because I overthink things. You know, words matter. That's not to say that I can use words wonderfully. But for me, the words I hear and how I interpret those words, precision of words is important to me. And so I think that's one of the reasons why sometimes in games I'm just like, I don't think I understand. I don't think we're on the same page. I don't know what I'm really supposed to do. I think you think I know what I'm supposed to do, but your description is not, I don't get it. So anyway, I've started to figure out Watch Dogs 2 a little bit more. I think what I'm going to have to do, instead of going the stealth route, because I kind of get tired of doing the whole puzzle thing, like, okay, here's the environment, here's the guards, and here's how they pace back and forth, here's their pacing pattern, and you got to keep this guy in mind and this guy in mind, and then after those two, you got to factor in this guy, da 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 da. And I'm just like, you know what? I think I just need to kill them all. At the end of my workday, don't have much time for the hard, deep thinky as far as strategy goes. So, anyway. So I feel like I'm getting a feel for that. What else did I do? Oh yeah, I got a couple of movies on my Christmas list. One was Warcraft, which I hadn't put on my Christmas list right away. I just I waited till the price was good and low, and it's like, you know, I don't want me or anyone else to pay, you know, significant amount of money to offer this, but it was like really cheap, and so I put it on my Christmas list, and I watched it, and you know, sure, yeah, I got the CG curse that was still in full effect. But what was interesting to me was that I enjoyed it more this time around than I did when I watched it in the theater. I went and watched my review again, actually, after watching the movie. I was like, what was my beef with this? What was I thinking and stuff? You know, those things were still there, but for some undescribable reason, I was just, maybe it was a different day, I was in a different mood, I don't know what. But I was moved more frequently by some of the story, by the plot and character elements than I was the first time through. Moved by some scenes and some character choices that, you know, were hard to make. Like, there's a main half-orc character who has to make a tough choice near the end of the movie. And it moved me in a way that it didn't move me the first time I saw it in theaters, you know. So I think what I'm going to do with that one from now on whenever I watch it is dial down the color a little bit on my TV screen. I experimented with that a little bit because it was just, as I mentioned in my review way back when, just kind of really colorful and kind of betraying its video game roots, you know, in terms of its design aesthetic. And so I discovered that dialing down the color a little bit, you know, not all the way to black and white, you know, not even close, but just like easing off a little bit so it has a little bit more of that Lord of the Rings kind of feel to it, you know, or Matrix or Underworld, where it's all kind of, you know, it's just a little more monochromatic for my taste. It just grounds the thing in, you know, in a weird way. It kind of grounds the whole thing for me, makes it a little bit more serious, maybe. I don't know how to explain that. You either know what I'm talking about or you don't. Sorry, guys. Let's see what else. I also watched the extended cut of Suicide Squad, which I also got as a Christmas gift. And I got to say, I prefer the theatrical release. You know, I think I said this in my review of that movie, but like really, much like a Marvel movie, the jokes almost all fell flat for me in that movie. Or the quips, or whatever you want to call them. I kind of feel like they're kind of the same thing. Can you tell I didn't write down any notes about this part of the show? Jeez, I'm talking way too long. This show is already insanely long. I gotta zip this up. I prefer the theatrical. Blah, blah, blah. Oh, it's a Christmas movie. That's cool. I forgot about that. That there's a scene with a Christmas tree in the background where Deadshot, he's talking to his little girl, and they're walking through the store, they're walking through the city, and there's like store lights and Christmas trees and stuff in the background. I'm like, all right, I can officially add this to my annual Bake-a-thon Christmas event where I watch a bunch of nerd movies that I can justify as being Christmas movies because they have some kind of Christmas element in them, however brief it is. I also got a Steam controller for Christmas. I've only played with a little bit. But I'm looking forward to tinkering. It's going to be a slow tinkering with that. I don't have the patience for that kind of thing. It's why I'm a console gamer, not a PC gamer. I don't have patience for dinking around and tinkering and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I would really like a cool option for some of those point-and-click-oriented type RPGs that I like playing on PC. It would be nice to have, like, some kind of a controller option for that. I also had a great Dungeons and Dragons night with a new group that's composed a lot of the same people from the previous group that I had been in, but the game master moved away, and so someone else had to kind of step up, and you know, since they had a slightly different circle of friends, it kind of became a slightly different, composed of slightly different people, but all people that I know from other parts of my life, and I get to play Eldarash, this nasty old evil wizard. He's kind of like a poop wizard who, like, he thinks that, like, somehow, in his quest to gain power and rule the world, that, like, feces and bodily fluids are going to somehow revolutionize how magic is done. So he kind of tries to work that into his spell components, rubs feces all over his staff, usually works feces into the missions. Like, once we were trying to convince everybody that we were trying to rescue a guy, and the way we thought we could rescue him is convince everyone that he has this horrible plague. And so when I went up posing as a doctor... With the bard who was actually doing the talking, so he could help me get away with this. He walked us up there in the guise of, like, you know, physicians, and I got up to this guy because he was, you know, tied to a pole in a public place, and I had, you know, some of my own feces handy. I usually do when I'm playing Eldrast. I mean, I have some of Eldrast feces handy. I'm obviously, you know, well, maybe not obvious to you, but just to let you know, not my own feces. And I walk up to this guy and I say, "We're here to rescue you," and I start pushing my feces into his mouth to help him, you know, give off the idea that he's he's got the weirdness plague. And then, like, in the last game that we did, because that was a while back, the last game we did, there was a girl that we were trying to smuggle past this like gypsy tribe or whatever the crap caravan that was potentially going to be, you know, looking for her, and the bard used his bard skills to, like, fix her up in a disguise and stuff like that as, like, this homely looking, you know, peasant and stuff, and I was like, yeah, well, we should add some poop to this equation. So I had to roll dexterity. I hadn't succeeded a dexterity roll, so I'd get away with it, but luckily this old guy is pretty quick with his hands. So, "It's for the best, my dear," he says as he's rubbing his feces all over her. You know, and then I figure that the gypsies aren't going to want to look at her, right? Okay, I've gone totally off the rails. I'm so sorry if you have a thing against, you know, hearing about feces. We're done. We're done with that. We got through it together. You know, I got a New Year's resolution this year, just as I wrap up the podcast. I don't usually do them unless I have a real plan to make them work. This year, I'm doing the first New Year's resolution... revolution that I've ever done in a long, long time. It's motivated mostly by vanity in the short term and by health in the long term. I sat down with Holly, my wife, to figure out a plan that will help me lose 6 inches from my waistline. I'm at 42 inches now while relaxed, 41 average over the last decade about, but the holidays were delicious. Sometime during college, I had a 36-inch waist, and that's where I want to go again. I wasn't taking care of myself during college either, so I think that this is doable. Over the last 3 to 4 years, I've developed an exercise habit and added a little muscle to my upper body. Not a lot, as you can see in the YouTube videos, but more than I would have otherwise. And now I want to ramp things up in both exercise and dietary life to slim down the middle while still building the upper a bit more if I can. Our youngest recently finished a lengthy incentive program we created to help him stop wetting himself so frequently. It involved both short-term and long-term rewards, so using that model, I am upgrading my routine and my life habits with rewards to motivate me. I talked to my wife to see where we could pull the money from, because she does wonderfully budgets for our family. She does the math. I mean, we talk about the budget, and, you know, we're on the same page. I'm more like the grand philosophical, like, okay, well, I want us to prioritize this and this and this, and then she does the number crunching, you know, and she's on the same, you know, she's on the same page with me philosophically too. We both kind of major in certain things, and then we still minor in the other things, but she definitely majors in the numbers. Me and math, not so good of friends. My current habit is a 15 to 20 minute morning workout, which has really just been upper body stuff, and I do that about 3 days a week, with a 5 minute, what I've called a placeholder jog, around the block in the evenings, with the intent that, like, I'm just building a habit now, carving it into my schedule, I'm going to lengthen this in time. Well, that time is now, as of yesterday. That is changing to a 25-minute workout in the morning. I got a little timer that I'm going to use to make sure it's absolute 25 minutes working out, not lacing up, not stretching, 25 minutes freaking working out in the morning, and then another workout 25 minutes in the evening every weekday, 5 days a week, 2 25-minute workouts, one in the morning, one in the evening. The evening workout will really be tough to add, so I'll be building to that for a while. Although last night I was able to do it, I'm going to do it again tonight. But in the meantime, every week that I do 25 minutes for 5 days in the morning, I get an extra $5 of fun money on Saturday. Not much, but enough, you know, for like to pick up a little Steam game or a little on sale game in the PlayStation store. So that's incentive for me. That works for me. And then once I'm ready, I cut the cord on that weekly incentive program and upgrade double or nothing, baby, to a $10 a week, to getting $10 a week for doing 2 25-minute workouts every weekday, one in the morning, one in the evening. No partial rewards for partial completion. It's all or nothing at that point. And that adds up to $40 of extra fun money per month. And that's, I can do something with that. I can do something exciting with that. So that's the short-term incentive program. The dietary changes will be more about just drinking lots of water, eating better, and eating less. You know, no fad dieting or precise formulas, just common sense, clean eating. And I'm going to need to do that to, I think, hit the long-term goal, because the exercise alone has not really budged my waistline at all. It's added muscle a little bit, but it hasn't changed my waistline. And I think that's going to happen by doing more cardio and then changing the way I eat. So long term, once I get my waistline to 34 inches while sucking in with all of my might, because I don't trust myself to truly relax fully during measurements. So I can currently ditch 2 inches by sucking in. So I was like, okay, so I want to be 36. So when I can suck into 34, then on that day, I am immediately awarded a full Hermit Gamer weekend, not necessarily starting that day, but, you know, I'll get to put one on the calendar, where I can go away to a hut somewhere completely by myself and game myself into a stupor for an entire weekend. You know, I can save up and buy a flashy console or other geek goodies if I am determined enough, but something like that, a getaway weekend where my wife is willing to watch the boys while I get away for a weekend, for an introvert like me, that's freaking priceless, baby. Well, I gotta tell you, that 25 minutes really felt like 25 minutes this morning and yesterday morning. So here's hoping and praying this will work like I think it will, and that God will teach and equip me with some useful things about self-discipline in the process. That's really something else that I really see as a potential benefit of coming out of this, of me just having some tough conversations with God where I just confess my infancy, you know, and in the realm of self-discipline. And I just confess that and just kind of work through the frustration of the, you know, of dying to myself a little bit to embrace a degree of self-discipline. So I'm really hoping that will be something good that comes out of this, in addition to, of course, all the vanity bonuses that in my flesh I really hope for. All right, that's it for this week, guys. Blah, 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 blah. Stay tuned for DS9 Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 400 if you want to start from the beginning. Next week, if God allows it, then we'll be back to the Book of Ephesians, and I'll be reviewing A Monster Calls, which is coming out in theaters next week. Till then, check out SpiritBlade.com and Christian Geek Central for more stuff made just for you guys. Thank you so much for making time for this show. I hope you have a great week, and that you'll join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground Podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Frampton with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.com. Thank you for listening.
Coming through the wormhole.
The Dominion has endured for 2,000 years and will continue to endure long after the Federation has crumbled into dust.
No! 5 years ago, no one had ever heard of Bajor or Deep Space Nine, and now all our hopes rest here.
And we're back from watching Blood Oath. Another Dax episode, but a much, much, much better one.
Ah, the joy of Klingons.
We have 3 Klingons, all from the original series. Koloth, who is in The Trouble with Tribbles. Kor, who is the first Klingon we saw from Errand of Mercy. And Kang from Day of the Dove. And they're all interesting characters, and we brought them back. And the only downside is we have to basically say Klingons are about as long-lived as Vulcans. But we can live with that, because these are all great actors and great parts that they brought back. Mm-hmm. Dax's last host was a good friend of the Klingons. He had helped bring peace with the Klingons and had made special friends with Kang, who was the leader of this trio. And while they were hunting down a pirate, he vowed revenge on them and managed to murder their sons, and so they swore a blood oath, as well as Dax. So
Dax had actually been the godfather to the murdered child.
Yes. And so so basically they're coming because they found him and they're ready to come and finish him off and finish their quest of vengeance after all these years. And at first they're reluctant to bring Dax along because it's not Curzon Dax, it's Jadzia Dax. And then she finally gets to join along, and so that's it. It's the first half is does she get to go on the adventure, and the second half is the adventure. And while I wish this had been a two-parter, though, because those are two separate stories, and I would like to see each one get its own episode so they could be fleshed out more.
I do enjoy the first half of the episode, because the question of does Dax get to join them in the quest for vengeance, it's not wasted time.
Yeah.
Not only do we get to really know, re-meet these Klingons, or know them for the first time if you weren't an original series watcher.
And to be fair, they weren't really that detailed in the original series.
Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot of deep characterization back then. But also, we get to see how Dax has to basically meet each of their challenges, prove that she is worthy. And I found that part very interesting.
And wrestle with the idea of, is this going to be murder, or is this justice?
Yeah.
Another valid question. I like that the Klingon personalities have basically become the Three Musketeers. You got Athos, Porthos, and Aramis. Which is, it's not deliberate, or it might be deliberate, I'm not sure, but it's at least, it's not overt, but it's still there, and it's a good way to appreciate who they are, because it's a good trio dynamic of guys.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they got the, so it's like an old dog's, you know, silver fox kind of thing where, you know, we're still sharp-eyed and sharp-toothed and we can still hold our own. You know, we have the adventure at the end, I wish we would have had more time because I would like to see some more action.
It was a bit abbreviated.
Yeah, it was abbreviated. They show up and they, you know, sneak through and, you know, then comes a big fight. But, you know, not a bad fight. It's fairly typical Star Trek fighting, but it's not bad typical Star Trek fighting. Very good episode. Plus, one of these Klingons will come back a few more times. And I would say all of his episodes, the core episodes, are really good episodes. So, we will definitely be seeing this again, but not for a while, not till Worf comes onto the show. But still, as a standalone story by itself, it's still a good story. We get to know more about the Klingons, and they're just good characters. And a good Dax story, which, frankly, we need, because most of Dax's stories are not that good.
Yeah, overall, you know, I'm not sure I'd put this on the essential DS9 list, but this is a very, very good episode that I would definitely recommend you watch.
I would say, honestly, given that Kor, who's introduced here, does come back a couple times, I would call it essential,
okay,
you know, for character stuff, even if the events don't lead to anything. But yeah, definitely check out Blood Oath if you get the chance. It's a good standalone story.
And good action, good moral question, good Trek.
And we'll see you next time for a story that did make a two-parter, and which will eventually lead to Star Trek Voyager.